Welcome back to the course on critical theory, cultural studies, and postmodern theory, considered in terms of civil liberty. I'm Michael Recklinwald, and this is Lecture 7. And today we're going to introduce this most nebulous and bewildering school of thought known as postmodern theory. I'll post a caveat here. This gets quite dense quite quickly. I try to introduce the terms as best possible, but there will nevertheless be some difficulty in undertaking this study. Postmodern theory is a very difficult field, often deemed utterly impossible to penetrate and written in the most obscurantist prose imaginable. But we're going to unpack it, demystify it, and make clear what we think is underlying here, what is being said and what is posited, what the results of this endeavor amount to, and how it connects to our major theme of cultural Marxism. Let's begin by introducing the field, introducing some of the precursors, and discussing just what the issues at stake are. Postmodern theory, should be noted, is a discontinuous set of theories that are postmodern in several respects. One of these respects has to do with the question of ontology. Just what is being as it sees it, and what are the conceptions of the subject? So what is this conception of the object world? What is the conception of the subject? The subject being the knower or the person. All of these are troubled under postmodern theory, as we'll see. Another way to look at this is by virtue of consideration of the issue of epistemology, or the theories of knowledge that are being posited. Just what is knowledge? How is it derived? What is the relationship of knowledge to the subject and the object world, for that matter? So all of these are very interrelated. Historiography is another issue that's under consideration, that is the conception of history and the writing of history. As we see in Theory and History by Mises, there is a relationship between the understanding of history and the understanding of theory. Here they come into definite play, and certainly we see that the notion of history and just what it is and how we write about it is involved in postmodern theory. Postmodern theory is also rather different in terms of conceptions of politics, the conceptions of the polis or the political body and social relations within that polis. We will discuss all of this as we get into the course here, into this segment of the course. All of these categories are related. The question of ontology or being is related to the question of knowledge. That is how ontological objects and the subject are understood, relates to what knowledge is and how it is derived. And that is true in any case, but it's particularly true in the case of postmodern theory. And so we will delve into that in depth. What is knowledge and how it is derived is relevant to how history is conceived and written. That is, how we think we know and what we can know certainly has an impact on how history is conceived and how it can be written. So knowledge epistemology relates to historiography, or how history is written. How history is understood, of course, is related to politics. Once we have a conception of history, then there's a conception of how people make history, and politics is, of course, one of the main means by which history is made. So we will discuss this. Thus, we could say postmodern theory is a philosophical movement dealing with ontology and epistemology, a historiographical movement dealing with questions of history and how it is written, conceptions of history, and a political movement dealing with what the polis is, what are the social relations within that polis, and how they are understood. We should also add, though, that postmodern theory deals with to a great deal, semiotics, or the study of sign systems. It is a movement concerned with semiotics or the study of sign systems. And since language is a sign system and language is connected to knowledge, particularly as postmodern theorists see it, semiotics is deeply connected to epistemology. How we relate, how we explain things, what language is, connects to what knowledge is, what knowledge can be had, and how we have it, if at all. Ontology and epistemology are related because the subject and the object are both conceived of differently, and they're troubled greatly. That is to say, there's a real troubling or a bracketing of the object and subject world in such a way that they're put into great question. There's a great skepticism regarding the object world and a great skepticism regarding the subject itself, as we'll see. So I'm trying to give you a broad outline of just how the field can be approached in terms of these issues. Okay, so let's jump into some of the precursors here. These are philosophers and other thinkers from whom the postmodernists jump off. They're jumping off points. They certainly don't adopt wholesale the views of these theorists or philosophers, but they certainly base a lot of what they're arguing on them and then go from there. Immanuel Kant, the counter-enlightenment philosopher that we discussed earlier, is certainly in a major jumping-off point for postmodern theory because he assumed that we cannot know things in themselves, that we couldn't know the object world as such, but we only have an apprehension of the objects of knowledge in terms of and dependent upon our and in conformity with our own faculties. That is to say, whatever regularity we see in the world is provided by the subject, not by the object world itself, but by the subject. What we perceive is the phenomenal, not the actual or the transcendental object. These remain, the transcendental object remains impenetrable to human knowledge as such. Hegel is an important precursor, especially for his problem of the subject and object relation and how he basically collapsed the two into each other. The subject and the object become collapsed into the absolute spirit or the collective subjectivity of humanity. And they are not separate as such. They are mediated by each other. And what does he mean by that? There's a mediation or a relationship by which they come into being. As Hegel put it, we find that neither the one nor the other, that is the subject or object world, is immediately present in sense certainty, but each is at the same time mediated. And that is to say, they are sensed only as part of the same this, quote-unquote, and now, quote-unquote. What is he saying here? I think we can approach it through the dialectic, which we've talked about before. That is to say, we might think of this in terms of the dialectical relationship that Hegel poses between everything, the subject and the object in particular. Neither is immediately present as such, but each depends on the other. That is to say, the identity of the subject depends on the object and vice versa. There is no subject without an object and vice versa. They're mediated by each other. There's a mediating relationship. That is, they come into being in relationship with each other. And this is an important distinction that's not drawn, actually, a distinction that's erased in Hegel that is certainly informative to postmodern theoretical thought. Friedrich Nietzsche is a major force for several reasons. The first one I'm going to discuss is this idea of the dissolving of the real and the apparent, that is, what seems to be and what is. For Nietzsche, this is a distinction that he drops. This is a post-Kantian move. That is, Kant had maintained the difference between the phenomenal world, the world of appearances, and the object world, the transcendental object, or the world as it really is. This distinction will be collapsed and dropped by Nietzsche and by many of the postmodern theorists, and in its place, the postmodernists will posit something called the simulacrum, and that is a seeming reality that displaces the real, if the real ever existed. There's this a great deal of focus and bandying about of this notion of the simulacrum for postmodern theorists, especially Jean Baudrillard and others. From Nietzsche, there is another element that's drawn, and that is this erasure of the I, or the subject. The I, or the subject, is considered a causal agent generally, but Nietzsche sees the I as posited only after the fact of thought or action, a post hoc construction of action. Say, I pick up this microphone and throw it across the room. No, I'm not tempted to do that, but I'm just saying. Rather than saying, who did that, Nietzsche would say, it was done, and the action is, the ascription of agency is only given because somebody has to be held responsible for having done it. So he thinks that the subject, as such, is a post hoc construction for responsibility's sake, for morality in particular. Here's a quote from Nietzsche to support this idea. People used to believe in the soul, as they believed in grammar and the grammatical subject, that is, I did this, the subject would be I. People said that I was a condition and think was a predicate and conditioned upon the subject. That is to say, I did such and such, I think. That makes thinking predicated on the I or the subject. But he says, thinking is an activity, and a subject must be thought of as its cause. This is typically how things are considered. But, he says, now, with an admirable tenacity and cunning, people are wondering whether they can get out of this net, wondering whether the reverse might be true, that think is the condition, and I is the conditioned, in which case I would be a synthesis that only gets produced through thought itself. So thought becomes the subject, I becomes the predicate of thought. So we only locate a subject after it does something, and this is a post hoc construction as he sees it. So for Nietzsche, the I or the subject is posited as a means for assigning responsibility for actions. It's not there as such. It's a way or a means for holding somebody morally responsible for what happens. And as a moral relativist in the extreme, Nietzsche likes to deconstruct this subject, as it were. And we will talk about what deconstruction means later. Thus, the I for Nietzsche is a post hoc construction, as I said. It's a social construction, in particular, for assigning blame or issuing rewards. Social because it's not, it's only ascribed by the social body. The I is held responsible by others. So it's a social construction as such. Now, another issue that Nietzsche wrote about that is important to the postmodern theorists is this idea that scientific knowledge is nothing but a series of metaphors hardened into accepted truths. Images are connected to words to represent multiple instances of something. And this is where concepts come from. Concepts are metaphors as such, that is, this is like that, that's a metaphor, or this is that, rather, this is one of those. This is how concepts are produced, and he says that concepts basically subsume or swallow all these instances voraciously, as I say, and the instances actually belie the concepts. That is, there's no real truth to the fact that the instance is exactly one of these. So he says concepts are lies. This goes a long way to the kind of epistemological relativism that we're going to see in postmodern theory. Nietzsche is also important for his historicism. Historicism means the writing of history such that we see the historical moment as a unique element for its time, that is, or a unique element period. Historicism means that we excavate the context of events, and those contexts actually explain the events, rather than some sort of trans-historical narrative that explains them with reference to a telos or a progress narrative. He drops this completely. For Nietzsche, history is rather a series of acts of forgotten moments that allow the repetition of these unhistorical moments to be seen as new. This is the notion of the eternal return. But the newness of something is really only possible or seen as such because of forgetfulness. Now, the forgetfulness is not so much central to what we're talking about here for postmodern theorists, but what is important is the sense of history as a series of basically acts that aren't necessarily tending towards anything, as in any trans-historical historiography would put it, but rather events that are in some sense ruptured from each other, that are contingent upon the moment, that don't necessarily bear any necessary relation to what follows. This is a very big theme in postmodern theory. Further on historicism, the conditions of this repetition are contingent, that is, they're peculiar to the historical moment. And so are the moments, the historical events as such. They are contingent upon the moment. That is to say, they are not derived from any necessary sequence, preordained or otherwise contributed post hoc. In fact, all progress narratives, he would say, are effectively post hoc constructions based on the historical present. So history is not a series of stages leading to the present, but a series of moments occurring in themselves. And that's very, very crucial to understanding postmodern theory, because they'll adopt this kind of historiography, this kind of conception of history, nearly wholesale in many cases. Historical moments are contingent on the moment, which is sounds like a tautology, but I don't know how else to put it. And history is comprised of ruptures for postmodernists. That is, it is not this series of events that can be seen as part of an ongoing narrative of a teleological progress narrative, but rather a series of ruptures of contingent moments that have no relationship to each other necessarily, except that they apparently follow one another. Now, another major point for the postmodern theorists that they pick up, and I've referred to this before, is the will to power. This is crucial to Michel Foucault, in particular, his notion of power, and also his notion of knowledge. According to Nietzsche, nothing exists except a will to power, which marks for some the terminal point of a philosophy of metaphysics. That is, if a will to power is what is, then all of these objects of metaphysics, the transcendental object, or for Hegel, this absolute spirit, are just bunk. And what we have instead is just will moving through the universe as such, or moving through space. It marks the end of these given ontologies, these things such as being and the transcendental object, or God for that matter, and especially in the case of Nietzsche. And here's a quote from Nietzsche to sort of illustrate his notion of the will to power. Life itself is essentially a process of appropriating, injuring, and overpowering the alien, the weaker, oppressing, being harsh, imposing your own form, incorporating, and at least, exploiting. But what is the point of always using words that have been stamped with slanderous intentions from time immemorial? This is from Beyond Good and Evil. As we can see here, we're dealing with the questions of ontology and politics. If this is how life is, if this is the way life is, if life is a will to power, in effect, and it involves appropriating, injuring, overpowering the alien, the weaker, oppressing, being harsh, then that certainly has political implications, no? So that's where politics comes in. Now, as I've said before, Foucault adopts this notion of power as essential, as central, but he stands Nietzsche on his head, analogously to how Marx stood Hegel on his head. That is to say, he accepts the body but inverts it. Rather than relishing the will to power, he will oppose power, especially the dominant power, and only champion underdogs. Heidegger, Martin Heidegger, a major force for the postmodern theorists. And in many respects, but let's begin with this one, this notion of derealization by the inframing that technology produces, which leaves in the postmodern mind a simulacrum or a simulation instead of the real. So Heidegger posited this idea that technology inframes our experience as such so that we undergo a derealization effect. That is, we're not living in the real. There's something else that's produced by the technological experience of modern reality. So this seems to verge slightly off of the track of philosophy, but it doesn't for him, because he's effectively a phenomenologist, and that is, following Husserl, he is arguing for really experience as central to the concepts of philosophy, that philosophy cannot divorce itself from how it is to experience the world as such. So inframing produces this kind of simulacrum in postmodern parlance, or a simulation instead of the real. But for Heidegger, being, that is, real being, can return in moments of anxiety or boredom or other, I guess, either extreme or horrible feelings. And during this time, we can recover being. Now, postmodernists do not share this notion of being's return. Being is banished, really, as we'll see. Instead, some postmodernists posit something more original than being, actually, which Derrida would call difference or difference, as I'll explain during that discussion of Derrida. It is an alterity or other that is more primary than being. That being is, in effect, again, like a post hoc construction of difference, differences between elements. Language in particular for Derrida, that is, the different language units or concepts or what is known as signifieds of language produce, vis-a-vis their friction more or less, the notion of the real, and that the real, or something more primary than the real, or being, is this difference or alterity. Now, in terms of Heidegger, while they don't judge Heidegger morally for his adhesion to Nazism, they do think they might explain it. Some of them see this other to the West as the excluded, and have figured this other that Heidegger is referring to as the Jew, an omission of which in Heidegger they say accounts for his complicity with the Nazis, although, as I say, they don't morally condemn him. And one of the chief founders of deconstruction, Paul de Man, in fact, was a Nazi sympathizer, as was later revealed. Again, to the eye or consciousness, for Heidegger, the I or consciousness underlying the metaphysical tradition of Western philosophy is superseded by the human being as Dasein, that is, being there or being in the world. This is something that's larger than consciousness. It is an awareness that is more than the consciousness of the thinking I. That is the subject of Descartes. You know, I think, therefore I am. That is Descartes' thinking cogito. Here he's saying that there is an awareness of personhood and mortality, of a past that never was present and a future that never is. That is the experience of the Dasein, or the subject for whom being matters as such. And this was unique to humans as far as he knew, or as far as he posited. That is, humans are the only existing being that he knows of that is aware of its own impending mortality. Another precursor for the postmodern theorist, and I mentioned him in lecture one as a psychoanalytic theorist, is Jacques Lacan. Jacques Lacan was a psychoanalytic theorist who basically, as I said, he took Freud's psychoanalytic method and converted it to symbolics through language, a symbolic system. Okay, so according to Lacan, the subject, the I, comes into being through language, through a symbolic system. That is, the self is known and becomes itself through its introduction to a language system, whether that be the actual, graphic language, or whether that be a system of symbols, which it is. Language is a feature of the symbolic order, as he suggested. That is, this order of symbols of society through which desire is mediated for humans. So he saw the human being coming into being as such through its interaction with and in regards to and interpolated by a language, by the symbolic order. This was particularly the case in what he called the introduction to the patriarchal element of society, that it comes into being through relationship with the father. The primary desire is recognized by the other, against which the subject recognizes itself. So the first desire is to be recognized by the other. And this recognition allows the subject to recognize itself as itself. The primary other is the mother, in Lacan, that is, and he calls this the mirror stage of development, in which the child basically sees him or herself in the eyes of the mother and comes to have a conception of itself which is entirely tied to the mother, which could he sometimes refer to as the mother. So the mother is the first other from which the self starts to derive its self identity. It starts to recognize itself as itself, but it must enter into the symbolic realm, be wrenched from the mirror stage and cast into the symbolic stage, which is the register of the male, or I should say the father, not male. Of the father. The ultimate desire, according to Lacan, is to occupy the place of the ultimate, or to be the signifier of signifiers, that is, the ultimate signifier, the phallus, that is, that which is symbolically represents or replaces the penis. And this is the means by which the subject and other are brought into relationship in the symbolic stage. What is necessary to get from this is that this notion of a subject coming into being vis-a-vis language in particular, through its relationship with a series of signifiers. In particular here, in this case, the signifier of signifiers, which is the phallus. This is the uber signifier, if you will. signifier that determines the order of the symbolic realm and of society as such, therefore. But to occupy the place of this ultimate signifier is impossible because, get this, the phallus is not a real existing object, but a function whose presence is an absence or a lack. That is, nobody can have the phallus because it really doesn't exist. We only come to recognize it as a function of the social symbolic order, which establishes the order, but which is in itself absent as such. It is an organizing function whose presence is an absence or a lack. This is particularly the case for the female, or one without the phallus, so to speak. But in all cases, the subject is incomplete. There's a lack in all cases. So this is one of the reasons that the feminist psychoanalytic theorist picked up Lacan as an important source for understanding and even altering the symbolic register, the symbolic order. Because, you see, it is purely imaginary, if you will. It is not something that has to be as such, and therefore they try to reorient the subject with reference to the phallic or the symbolic register as such. Postmodern feminists take up Lacan, as I said, for feminism because the symbolic order, being strictly symbolic, can putatively be changed, whereas under Freud, you couldn't change your biology. And this could explain, in fact, transgenderism as this exchange of the phallus as a symbolic object for gaining authority or losing it, etc. The subject comes into being through language, a symbolic system, and language is a feature of the symbolic order of society through which desire is mediated. Now, getting into language further, we come to Ferdinand de Saussure. I think he was Swiss. He's a very important figure for postmodern theory, especially for Derrida. Now, some of the claims or insights, if you will, if they're true, that Saussure asserted that became central to deconstruction in particular, and to a lesser extent, I guess, for post-structuralism, is that the idea that language is an arbitrary system of signification. We can see this. There's no necessary connection between the word tree and that which it signifies, a tree, but it's actually not the tree itself that it signifies for Saussure. It's the concept of the tree. The signified and the signifier are two parts of a sign. The signifier is the word, and the thing that it signifies is actually the concept, not the referent, which is something else, and I'll talk about that. And now, one of the important things here is that words only have meaning in relation to other words. So there's no meaning outside of language. Language, words themselves have meaning only as different from and in connection with other words. So a tree versus an orange. The meaning is not based on the difference between the tangible objects, if you will, if they exist, but rather between the word orange and the word tree and the concepts they elicit in the mind. Okay, so he includes the signifier, the sign or word, and the signified, the concept that a word or sign elicits, and the concrete reference. There are three parts to his notion of signification, if you will. The signifier, the word. I should not have sign there because actually the sign consists of the conjunction of the signifier and the signified. Well, let's just say word. The signifier and the signified are the sign, and together they point to a concrete referent outside of the sign for some. And that would be like the signifier is the word tree. The signifier is the idea of the tree in the mind. And the signifier and signifier together produce the sign that points to a concrete referent, the tree itself. And there's the outline of that. You can see that I've put the signifier and the signified in brackets or parentheses to note that they are the unit that form the sign, and they are different from the referent. And we're going to see for Derrida that the referent drops away, and even the relationship between the signifier and the signified is troubled a great deal. Another factor that Saussure introduced was this idea that language is both a synchronic and a diachronic medium. That is to say, language has both a synchronic use that in the moment, what it signifies in the moment, and a diachronic development, that is, it changes over time. This is really nothing that an etymologist couldn't tell you, but it is something. Saussure distinguished between the use of words, which he called la parole, and words as a part of an underlying system, la langue. So there's this repository of words, that's la langue, and then there's the use in time by a particular speaker or writer, that's la parole. So this distinction becomes something. We'll see what. So Ferdinand de Saussure begins the move taken up by deconstruction that sees language as a self-referential system whose units have meaning only in relationship with each other. And that becomes huge in Derrida, as we'll see. Language is references not to an outside reality, but rather to other texts. And this is known as intertextuality, that texts are related to other texts. They're not related to anything beyond themselves, that there is only, as Derrida would say, there's nothing but text, but we'll get into that. Now, of course, this has epistemological implications. That is, language use and how it is conceived certainly has implications for knowing. This notion of the intertextuality of language is one way that leads to postmodernism's extreme skepticism, as many see it, although many deny it as well, about the possibility of knowledge of the object world, or whether it exists, for that matter, as we'll get into with Derrida. Those are epistemological questions, how language relates to the object world, if at all. And therefore what we can know, because as the postmodern theorists see it, knowledge only comes through vis-a-vis language. This would finally lead to Derrida's assertion that there is nothing outside of the text. Yes, he actually did write that. As we'll see now, there's debate about what it means. But he said there is nothing outside of the text. Now, this has been taken to mean that on the one hand, that there's no reality outside of textuality, that there's nothing outside of language. On the other hand, it's meant to say that there's no talking about anything outside of language, that knowledge of anything outside of language becomes impossible because there's nothing outside of text. Even the way we, you know, walk through the world involves a text, if you will. You know, this is here, that's there, across the street. All these things are sign systems that we coordinate ourselves with. So we'll talk about what really Derrida, I think I have a particular take on Derrida, what I think he's really saying, and then I can explain what others hold as well. So that's it for the introduction to postmodern theory. We will take up in our next segment Jacques Derrida and deconstruction. Thank you very much.